Hi, my name is Karen. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Karen.
Turn the lights down. I'll feel like Bette Midler. I think my favorite movie moment ever is in a Bette Midler movie called For the Boys. And she's giving a concert. She's getting ready to sing for this room full of British soldiers overseas. And the power goes off. And you hear her voice, and she's alone in the dark with hundreds of men. There is a God after all. And that described me when I was out there for sure. It's a little different today. It's a little awkward for me actually to share in a room full of men and being the only woman here. So I'll have to get Sandy back into the front row. I've shared a lot in the last little while, and it's funny. People ask me how come my story is never the same. You know, they'll hear it on our website, or they'll see me, and you know, the deal is that there are no 2 days that are the same, and depending on what I'm going through on the day, it's the stuff that comes out, you know. And sometimes I get up and it's like I've done this my whole life, and I'm really comfortable, and it's really funny and upbeat and happy and spiritual and all that other stuff. And other times I'm a little shakier, and lately I've been shaky. Really shaky. I'm going through something, and I'm getting a lot of advice on how to deal with it in the concrete. You know, call this person who'll help and do this and go fix that and fill out these papers and go to this place, and it's not what I need. What I need is to hear from other people who've gone through it so I can figure out how to do it without drinking. That's what I need. I need to know how to deal with the shame and the remorse and the regret and the fear of the unknown, because I'm too paralyzed right now to go find out what's going on. That's what I need. Surprisingly, it's a lot like I felt when I first got sober. Well, I'll go back. I'll just give you what it was like before I started drinking. Was what I guess it is for a lot of us. I felt like I didn't belong, and I felt different, and I had no social skills at all. I was an English Protestant kid growing up in a textile town, and my parents decided that for their kids to stay in Quebec, the good thing to do would be to send them to French school, and they started me off when I was 4 in a convent. This was before French immersion existed in Quebec, I wasn't allowed to speak any English at all. So it reinforced, I guess, my feeling of feeling different and not belonging. And in grade 2, when the other kids were going for their first communion, they were doing all their lessons and stuff in the church with the priest. It's funny, it usually comes out, I say I wasn't allowed to go because they thought I would pollute the process. I think now it's interesting that I look at it that way, that I was a polluting force there. I wasn't Catholic, so I didn't get to go. So these kids would go, and I would sit in front of the principal's office doing math quizzes, which I really enjoyed and I was good at. And he would give me a big barley candy sucker, those big red ones with like the rockets for eyes and the licorice for the, you know, one of those. And so these kids would come back from church for morning recess. They would have had the host. I don't know if any of you know what that's like, but it ain't no candy. And I'm standing in the schoolyard with this big, huge sucker, wondering why nobody wants to be my friend, why they don't like me, why they resent me. And when I got into high school, almost the opposite happened. I thought, I'm going to finally be with my people. Right? I'm going to be in English school now. Except that I was so French by then that they all called me a Pepsi and a fraud, you know. So I was confused, really confused about who I was and where I belonged and what I needed to do to get people to like me or pick me for a team, you know. It's not by accident that I was a sports fanatic. I did a lot of sports. I was really athletic, but they were all individual sports. It was cross-country running. It was gymnastics. It was diving. It was not team stuff. I didn't know how to be part of a team, you know, and I really wanted to be. So when I was 14, 15, I fell in with a bunch of bikers. They opened up a disco. This community that I lived in at this point was a dairy farm community. And there wasn't anything to do. There were no movies. There was a bowling alley had closed. There was no donut shop. There was literally nothing. So they opened up a disco across the street from the only bar in this small town. And we would go to the disco. And the very first time I went, there were older guys who were going into the bar and bringing drinks out for us. And I so relate to Bill. I had arrived, you know, for the first time ever. I felt comfortable, I felt funny, I felt pretty. I felt like I belonged somewhere. And when 11 o'clock came and it closed and my dad came to pick me up, I regretted. I would almost cry. I didn't want that night to end. And I couldn't wait for the next Friday night to come soon enough, you know. And Dad had stopped in Valley Field for donuts. He brought home donuts, and I had my first drinking lesson. Because I got home, and I took a big, huge, ice-cold glass of milk, and I scoffed a couple of donuts, and I threw up the whole way up the back stairs to my room. And the next morning, I woke up, and I had a headache, and I felt sick to my stomach. I couldn't remember half of what had happened the night before, except that it had been glorious. And the lesson for me wasn't drink less. It wasn't if you feel this way, don't drink or drink less. It was no milk and donuts after drinking. That was it. And there were tons of lessons like that. Tons. No spaghetti before drinking. You know, I want to do the spaghetti. No, no, no. Hot dogs. Hot dogs are really bad before drinking. And you're feeling crappy the next morning, a little shot of booze will fix it. You know, there were all these little steps, these little things. And when I fell in with the bikers, I realized I was a cheap drunk. I would get drunk on 2-3 beers, flat on my rear end. And I was embarrassed by that because these guys could really hold their liquor. And it was the first goal I ever set myself in my whole life, was to learn how to drink like the boys. And I did. I switched from beer and wine and pretty girly stuff to Jack Daniels and Jose Cuervo. And the less junk in my booze, the better. I was a really hard drinker. I drank a lot, and I drank daily. And I was one of those lady drunks that you see in bars where I would order my drink and it would come with ice in it, and I never asked for ice. I never mixed my alcohol with anything. I'm efficient that way. I'm Scottish a little bit, I think, so I like things efficient. If I'm going for a goal, I want to get there, and I don't want to dilly-dally on the way. And it didn't matter what kind of place I was in. I would stick my hand in the glass, pull out the ice cubes, and throw them on the floor and tell the waitress not to do that again. And my life spiraled out of control really, really quickly. I started school really young, so I was in CEGEP, sort of in between high school and university here in Quebec. And I started when I was 16. I was living away from home. I drank my summer's earnings in the first 3 weeks, got a job there, and I flunked out twice in a row, 2 semesters in a row. They asked me to leave for good. I moved in with some. I moved in with my parents for a couple of weeks, but that didn't work out so well. So I moved in with 3 other girls in a sort of a medium-sized town, and I started working in a donut shop and then McDonald's, and you know, it was just kind of like that. You know, the girl with all the potential, here on the toilet. When I was 17, I got pregnant. When I was 18, I married her father. When I was 19, I divorced him, or left him anyway. And I guess I was 20 when we divorced, and it was just this steady stream, this living one day at a time. In an active alcoholic sense, as if tomorrow probably would never come. And I actually most days hoped it wouldn't. I remember feeling sad on my 21st birthday because we live fast to die young. And I didn't think 21 was all that young. I thought, okay, like, let's get this over with. I'm not going anywhere anyway. And I also acted like there was no bills to pay ever. I didn't have to save up to pay the rent. When it got out of control, I just moved. I moved 17 times in 4 years, you know. One place to another, and yesterday never happened either, and if it did, it wasn't my fault. That's kind of how I saw it. You know, half the time I was a blackout drinker, I didn't remember half of what happened anyway, but I wouldn't own it. It didn't matter if I remembered it or not. It wasn't my fault. There was always someone or something to blame. And I spent the last couple of years of my drinking with this huge idea that life wasn't fair and I wasn't getting what I was deserving, and you know, my brother and sister were flourishing, and I guess I was the example of what not to do. That's how I saw my life. I'm just a big example of how not to live. And pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. It's funny, I guess talking about it tonight, I realize that what I'm feeling right now in my situation isn't anywhere near what it was at the end of my drinking. Because at the end of my drinking, I literally was hoping that God would pull me out of a speeding car as I dangled out the window, hoping, you know, too afraid to let go, hoping for a mechanical failure or something, and I would just get whisked off the edge of the earth. I just wanted it to end. And I remember getting in the metro, the subway. I was starting to have hallucinations, and I was paranoid. And this was pretty much all on alcohol. I didn't do a lot of drugs. I was afraid of drugs, and I was allergic to a lot of stuff, too. So I didn't do a tremendous amount. But I remember even just on the booth, being at the point where I'd get on the subway and I'd have to hug the wall because there were evil spirits down there trying to lure me in. And I was afraid that one of them would grab me and pull me in front of the metro, you know? And then I have these little moments of clarity, these little moments of truth would come out. And that's one of them. I remember one night being really scared, and my boyfriend at the time was holding me, and he said, "Don't worry, I'm not going to let anything hurt you." And I said, "You don't understand. I'm not afraid of anything out there. I'm afraid of myself." It wasn't about something going to pull me in. I was afraid I was going to jump, you know? One day the fear wouldn't be strong enough, and I would just do it. I'd want a nervous breakdown so I could stop thinking for 5 minutes, you know? Kind of where I was at. Physically, it was bad. My liver was swollen. I had veins breaking out on my face. I bruised it, nothing. I had a lot of damage done by the time I stopped. And in fact, I started getting well probably a year and a half before I even came close to AA. I hit a bottom. I ended up living with a guy who worked in psychiatric ward at the Montreal General, who knew how to nurse me and look after me. And he wasn't an alcoholic. And I noticed for the first time things like the DTs, like the shakes, because I wasn't drinking every day. I wasn't working in bars anymore. And when I didn't drink, I would tremble and I'd sweat, and things were bad. I had a hard time sleeping and eating and all that stuff. And he sort of nursed me back to health, because I went through months a couple of times where I couldn't leave the house, couldn't shave, couldn't feed myself. I was pretty sad. And at the same time, I thought I was the hottest thing. I thought I was such great stuff. I thought I was wonderful. The denial's pretty strong. We didn't have mirrors in that place either, though. Maybe that has something to do with it. It was a senior citizen's home, and they didn't have any mirrors on the walls, so that's pretty funny. Anyway, what happened is that things started getting a little bit better on the outside, and a little better on the outside, and I had a legitimate job, and things were okay. And on the inside, I was just dying. And my mom joined AA. She broke her anonymity to me one day, and she'd been spending a lot of lunch times at my house crying in my kitchen. I remember my first reaction when I heard she joined Alcoholics Anonymous was, "Thank God she's got friends her own age, and she'll go cry in their kitchens and give me a break." Because it was a little bit of a bummer to have mom crying in my kitchen all the time. And slowly, over a couple of months, she talked to me about what AA was doing for her, and what alcoholism was, and what the program was about, and sponsorship, and spirituality, and all this stuff. And I thought it was really great for her. You know, in the meantime, I'm trying to put my life together. I'm trying to control the drinking. I'm trying to keep it under wraps. I'm trying not to let anybody know what's going on. You know, I'm leaving my daughter alone so I can sneak out and go drinking. And she's the one waking me up in the morning because I can't get out of bed without help. And she's running to the neighbors for Band-Aids. So she sees me coming with a first aid kit, and she starts to cry, you know. The funny thing about not knowing where she was, I'd wake up sometimes after going out drinking, and I wasn't concerned about her so much. I knew what I'd done was wrong, but I didn't want anybody to find out because I was afraid of what they'd think of me. And that's pretty self-centered. So mom's telling me about AA, and one day she tells me that she needs some support to go to this meeting. She's going to a meeting in LaSalle, and I think it was Tuesday LaSalle. One of the nicest meetings. If you've never been, you should go. A really tremendous meeting. But she tricked me. She told me that there were a lot of men there who went after women, and mom was newly separated, and I thought my mom was really innocent. I'd seen way more of life than she had. And I knew that mom wouldn't know how to handle it if some man approached her and offered to take her to bed, which I thought was disgusting anyway. So I went there to protect my mom, and that was how I got to my first AA meeting, was this my mom's bodyguard. And I sat in the meeting, and just exactly what I thought. The guy up front was in his 50s. He'd been a street bum. And that's what I thought an alcoholic was. I thought an alcoholic was somebody who was drunk all the time, who was a man in his 50s, who dribbled from every orifice, and whose sweat was so corrosive it poked holes in his shirt. Like, that's what I thought it was. It was not a 23-year-old young woman. I thought I was still in reasonably good shape, able to speak. Until I stopped drinking, I was able to speak. And everything he said, it never occurred to me that people who don't have a drinking problem don't sit in the back of the room comparing themselves to the speaker, going, "Well, I didn't do that, and that's not me, and that's not like what happened, and this is, it was different." You know, like, they don't do that. People who have a drinking problem do that to try and convince themselves they don't have a drinking problem. And after a while, you know, Mom kept inviting me to these meetings, and I kept going. And one day I'm sitting in the room, and there was a woman in the front who was sharing, and she was in her 20s. And she talked about all the horrible feelings I was feeling in the day, every day. The guilt, the remorse, the shame, the feeling of having a double life, of people not really knowing who I was. And I had this tremendous sense that I had this black hole inside me that was eating me up. And it was getting so full and so big, it was about to erupt. And when it did, everybody would see it and everybody would know who I was. And I was really afraid of that. And she talked about those feelings, and she talked about it from a completely other space. She didn't feel those things anymore, and I could tell that she didn't feel them. And more than anything, I wanted to be happy and I wanted to be normal. And I thought if I did what she did, that might happen for me. And that's how my journey in AA started. And that was probably about 2 weeks after my last drink. I didn't consciously put it down. I don't know what happened. The desire to drink left me for that little bit of time, by the grace of God, I guess, so that I could hear that speaker and I could connect and I could join up with you. Because once I decided to join AA, the cravings came back. And they lasted for over a year, where I wanted to drink all the time. And I couldn't listen to the music I listened to before. I couldn't go downtown because the person who got off the bus downtown was that person who drank. And that tough girl, that street girl. And I didn't like her. I was afraid. I thought, I guess that's where I was. I accepted the fact there were two different me's. And I accepted the fact that one of them was a drinker and the other one was trying to be a good girl. You know, and it took a long time for me to reconcile that. But that's the way it was, and I would do stupid things. You know, I remember one time calling my sponsor early. I was in my first few weeks of sobriety, and I called my sponsor, and I said, I got this terrible craving. I'm going to drink. I just know I am. And she asked me what I was doing, and I was listening to a tape of music that had been made for me when I was working in the bars. And she said, well, you might want to turn that off. Now, what else are you doing? And I said, I'm having a glass of orange juice. I'm doing the good thing. And she knew who I was. She goes, what are you drinking it out of? I'm like, a wine glass. She's like, why? Why are you doing that? These little triggers, these things I did, like I would sort of pass my drinking life consciously in front of my eyes almost to tease myself. You know, look, I'm doing the right thing by drinking it in a wine glass. It's a healthy thing in the wine glass. She told me to get off my ass. Throw it out. Get rid of the wine glasses. And the brandy snifters, because I used to drink milk out of those. And old-fashioned glasses for chocolate milk, I guess, because I wanted to remember other things, you know. So it was a whole bunch of stuff I was asked to do. Let go of my friends, let go of old ideas and prejudices, and try and come to meetings and keep an open mind, and above all, don't take that first drink. And I didn't get it. I guess I didn't get it until I started reading the big book with other people in earnest. And really they explained alcoholism as a two-faceted illness. It's a disease. It's not something I chose to do. I heard somebody the other night say, when's the last time you heard an alcoholic or a drunk or anybody walk into a bar and ask for a cold or the flu if we don't ask to be alcoholics? And it's an illness with two facets. And the first one for me is that it's an allergy. And that means for me today that when I drink, something happens to me that doesn't happen to my brother and sister. When I drink, the first one, I can't stop. I don't know when it's going to stop. And I not only don't know where it's going to stop, I don't care. Once I start drinking, I don't care, you see. I might care when I'm sober who I hang out with and who I sleep with and where I go and what I do and how much money I spend and who I hurt, but when I'm drinking, I don't care. And that's partly how it gets me where it gets me. I don't care. So that's the first part. It triggers this allergy. It triggers this craving for more. And the second part is that I have no natural defense. As an alcoholic, I don't have the capacity to say no to the first drink. Which sort of makes it strange that we tell you don't take that first drink. Because we know we don't have the capacity to say no. What the program does and what the habits that I got to know here did for me was that it helped put a moment in there where I got to think. See, naturally as an alcoholic, if you put booze in front of me, my hand is going to reach out and get it. I forget. I forget that I can't handle it. I convince myself this time is going to be different. This time I won't get drunk. This time I'll stay in a safe place. This time I'll only be with people I know. This time I won't empty the bank account. This time I'll only go with $20. And I fool myself into thinking that a woman can't have people buy drinks for her and not everybody's safe. And I might go with somebody safe, but I used to dump them there and go off with other people or do my own thing, go places I wasn't supposed to be. I forget. And what the steps in this program allow me to do is before I have the opportunity to reach out and grab it is to remember those things. coming to meetings helps me remember those things, because I hear people new, and I hear people coming back, and I hear people who've been around for a long time all sharing what their last drink, their last week, their last year was like. And that allows me to put what I call a God moment in between me and the drink. It allows me to go, no, I know I can't do this. No, I know what's going to happen. And they taught me to do that by picking up the phone and calling people, by going to meetings, by trying to play it out to the end. Hey, okay, remember, you're going to have that moment of bliss after one or two or three or four. And then what? Because I only stopped at the part where I had the bliss. That thing that alcohol gave me, where there was that moment where everything was okay. Everything felt all right. There was peace. But it doesn't last long. It doesn't last long, and then I'm going places I didn't want to be. You know? And that's what it does. It allows me to think about that so that I don't have to pick that up. And it gives me the tools to look at that. Because, you know, that girl that had the barley candy and didn't know how to react around other people, and that little girl who felt different and unworthy and not deserving of happiness, incapable of being normal. I was like that before I had a drink. Once I put the drink down, I had to use the steps to figure out how to heal that. Steps are a great tool for healing that. I drank because I didn't feel right. Drinking made me feel right for a while. Then it destroyed my life. And I got to kind of go backwards now. Stop the drinking, and then you got to use the steps to try and figure out how you want to live today. So the first thing is the powerlessness. By myself, I'm powerless. With you guys, I'm not. With you guys in the program, I have the choice today to pick up the phone or pick up a drink. Simple as that. And my life is unmanageable when I do drink, and I know I don't want to do that anymore. Second one tells me, by examples that I see in here, it doesn't matter what God you pick, because everybody here's got different gods. It helps restore us to sanity. And the hard part for me was convincing myself that restore was the right word, because I wasn't sure I'd ever been sane, so I wasn't sure how that would work. But it works reasonably well. I didn't know what God would want to do with me, because I turned my back on God, but that worked itself out too. I just kept going, step three. Turn my will and my life over to the care of God. And over the years, that's changed. What God is and how I practice it, all that stuff has changed. I've gone through spiritual crises where I got really tangled up with definitions and how I was going to observe it and how come I wasn't getting what I was supposed to get, comparing myself to others, which I'm doing a lot today, and all this stuff. And it was just let it go. You know, the third step really is about doing all the other ones. The big book tells me if I read it through chapter 5, I do step 3 by moving on to step 4 and cleaning house. And it's true, old-timers, when I first came around, I'd say, how do you do step 3? And they'd say, follow through till 12. You get to step 3. You understand it better once you finish the rest of the steps. If you're stuck on 3 because you're trying to get it or figure it out, you're going to be there a long time. That's what they told me. And they were right. I was there a long time. 4 came because I was just so angry one day I thought I was going to kill somebody. So I grabbed a piece of paper and started writing down resentments. And I was surprised at how many silly things I kept that were like the end of the freaking world for me. The drama. You know, I was so twisted when I got here that I would react the same way if my best friend died and if I broke a coffee cup. Really. No perspective. No sense of perspective at all. None. And step 4 and 5 helped me a lot, gaining perspective. I got to write down this thing. I hated this girl. Her name is still on the tip of my tongue. It's high school, early high school. And the reason I hated her was because she had bigger boobs than me in grade 8. And when I wrote it and I saw it, I laughed. I laughed at myself for carrying that resentment around. What a waste of energy. And what was worse was that resentment in high school deprived me of a really good person as a friend. She was one of the nicest people is today, one of the nicest people that you'll ever meet. And I couldn't be friends with her because of something that superficial. That's pretty twisted, you know. So immediately in writing it down, a lot of this stuff sort of poofed, evaporated. And then I was scared. Step 5, I had to go tell somebody else. And I have a really hard time telling other people who I am when it's yucky stuff. I like it when I look good, right? I want to tell you the crap I've done. I was sure my sponsor would never let me in her house again. And instead, it turned out she did all the same things, some a little better, some a little worse. It kind of depended on the day, you know. And we were pretty much all the same. And so I today think that step 5 helped me join humanity. It made me human. It made me just one other person with a bunch of problems, just like everyone else. you know. 6 and 7 were harder. I didn't find that the book said enough about them. But then I figured, you know, the guys who wrote it were only a couple years sober, right? If you tell me not to think about an elephant, I'm thinking about an elephant. I can't help it. If you tell me don't do something, I can't imagine what that means. To me, it means sit on your hands and don't say anything. And those of you in the room that know me know I am not capable of sitting on my hands and not saying anything. I can't. Don't be a bitch. Okay, what does that mean? What does it mean, you know? And those little suggestions that were made, do a good deed every day for somebody and don't tell anyone. It's partly the 12th step, I think, as well. But that was part of the changing of behavior where I got to see, okay, maybe not being a bitch is to help somebody do something. And I could do that. You know, if you're constantly criticizing someone, okay, let yourself criticize, but make sure you start off by saying something nice about the person, place, or thing. Well, I stopped criticizing a lot because I didn't have anything nice to say to lead off with. Yeah? But these are all little things where they help me take the things. So I think today we're all born with good and bad in us. You know, I think when we're out there drinking, we nurture the bad stuff because it's what helps us survive. I needed to be tough, and I needed to be cold, and I needed to be bitchy, and I needed to talk a lot to blindside you, and I needed to do a bunch of that stuff just to be okay and get through it. I don't need those things today. So today it's about not feeding those things, but feeding something else. Feeding generosity and love and peace and warmth and all those things that we all have in us, even if we've almost extinguished them. They never go out entirely, those little flames. So I have no watch and I have no idea how I'm doing on time, so you'll have to like wave when I'm...
We're not waving.
No. Okay, good, you're not waving. So there you go, 6 and 7. I didn't mean for this to be a step share, but I guess it is, so we're more than halfway through, eh? 8 and 9 were not so obvious. 8 and 9, I had the list. I was willing, pretty much. I was willing pretty much to do whatever it took to not pick up a drink again, because I never wanted to go back to that same place. Never wanted to go back there. And frankly, slippers scare me, because you guys come back. Slippers come back. And that starts to feel sometimes like maybe it's okay to drink. But I think so. I think I'd rather remember the way I was at the end and how sick I was. Even if it's not true, I'd rather feel that it'll kill me if I do it. So I was willing to say I was sorry, and I think I had good sponsorship because by the time it came to amends, I was pretty clear on what I was making amends for, and I also had already made my peace with it. And I wasn't on that list. That list of amends, I didn't need to say sorry to myself. I was told that amends weren't about saying I was sorry, because I used to say sorry so much people would tell me to shut up. You know, amends was about behavior and about changing behavior, and living sober and living these steps was how I was making amends to myself. So that's what I did. But it did mean saying I was sorry to others and being really clear about which parts I was sorry for. And the 4th step was really great for that. At one point it asked me to put aside what other people had done and to look at how I fanned the flames. Even if I wasn't responsible for what happened, I usually aggravated the situation. Usually with my tongue. Usually with sarcasm. Usually with cruel words. And so I had an opportunity to make things right with people that I hurt very, very deeply. Family, mostly. 10, 11, and 12 are amazing. 10's been an ongoing journey for the last 21 years. Pretty much every day, trying to figure out what God is and how to get into better contact with my higher power. And it's taken all sorts of forms. I heard a guy the other night who was so funny talking about the lengths that he went to try and get in touch with God, and it sounded so familiar to me. You know, on my knees, not on my knees, on all fours, sitting in a Buddhist meditation class, up on top of the mountain in a monastery, being blessed, being baptized, going and having communion in every possible church and denomination there was. I even went to Catholic confession once, even though I'm not Catholic. Still, just because I thought maybe it was a key, there was something that I wasn't doing right because I kind of didn't feel it, and it came over time. I guess it came over time, knowing how to listen and follow my heart. Don't trust my heart most of the time. It's hard to do. So we'll keep trucking at that. Hey, more amends every day. Good things to note every day. things to talk over with a sponsor every day, at the end of the day. And service. You know, service, 12-step work. Everything we do in service is about the newcomer, and that's what the 12-step is about. It's about putting this into practice so we can be good examples, and it's about reaching out to newcomers, and I do a lot of service, and I started off with young people's stuff and a great convention. I traveled all over North America doing it. I got to see great things and meet great people, really great people. Service is where the majority of my support system comes from. I've gone through rough times in the past, and it's not usually, and I'm not talking about this home group, because this home group is great, but at the time, there was a home group I belonged to that sort of let me fall through the cracks, even though I asked for help. And what I found was that the people that I had done service work with on committees were the ones who showed up from a variety of different groups and parts of the city, probably because they're used to going the extra length to reach out. They're used to getting in the car and driving a couple of hours, or lugging stuff around and helping moving and all that kind of stuff, because we move the office once in a while too. So that's been a great blessing for me, and I've continued doing that. And it's a tremendous thing to be able to serve. And today I have two service jobs. Really, I'm an advisor for the Young People's Activity Committee, which is good. It helps keep me humble, because when I like to think I still am young, I go to their meetings and find out I'm not. They've been gracious. They've told me that we have young people here, we have old people here, and we have one in transition. So I'm in transition from young to old. And I'm glad to be able to go there and meet with these teenagers and people in their early 20s who are so enthused about reaching out to young people, because they know what a struggle it is to stay sober when you're young. There's a lot of temptation out there. Most of your friends aren't living a responsible, happy life either. So it's easy to get pulled back. And it's great, because they're the future also of AA. They'll be here long after most of us are gone. And it's great to see the enthusiasm and the dedication they have to trying to put the principles into practice in what they do. They're having an event on the 31st of December for New Year's Eve. If you're interested, I have tickets with me, so you can come and see me after. If you want to get involved, you can come see me too. And the other thing I'm going to be coordinating the grown-up convention, the area convention next year, and what an amazing team working on that event as well. And you see how my spirits lift when I just talk about these two groups of people, when I talk about home group, you know. It's good to surround yourself. There's a safety net thing we do here. I think if you're new and you haven't made use of those numbers, you haven't gotten numbers, give yours away. Let us call you. I wouldn't call anybody. I got tons of numbers when I first came in. I didn't call anybody. But they asked me for mine, men and women, and they told me it was up to me, and I felt very comfortable making the decision who would get it and who wouldn't. And they called. So I didn't have to have anybody tell me that because I was new, I was the most important person in the room. They showed me. And they showed me by calling me before the meeting and inviting me along, by asking if I needed a ride. We would go for coffee afterwards if I was feeling off or unsure about going home. And if I didn't show up, they called me the next day to ask if everything was okay. And all those things we tell ourselves about newcomers, I don't think I'm that unique anymore, so I'm not speaking for all newcomers. I didn't feel like anybody was checking up on me or monitoring me or harassing me or any of that stuff we say we're afraid of. I felt cherished. I had people I knew cared about me, and that was a long time. You know, nobody from the bars called me after I stopped drinking. I'd say, hey, where are you? None of them. Not one. But boy, people in meetings did. So give us an opportunity to do that by giving us your number. If you can't make those calls. The calls and the friendships you do make, that's going to be your safety net. When you do fall off the tightrope, sometimes sobriety is a bit like a tightrope. When you do fall off, it's good to have that. It's good to have that safe landing zone. Give that to yourself. Use it. So, I don't know what else to say. You know, I've had the most amazing time sober and the happiest time sober, and I wouldn't still be at it all this time if it weren't worth it, right? Just right now it sucks, and I guess the thing that time gives me is that I felt this kind of panic before, this kind of fear and shame, and I got myself into a jackpot. And now I'm trying to play ostrich, you know, and partly I'm going to accept my punishment. I don't care to participate in it. I'll just wait for it to come, you know. Not a great place to be. But I know I don't have to drink over it because I know there are other people that have done it. And that was a promise that we don't need at meetings, but that was made, and I'll leave you with this. And it was when I first got here, I thought I was so different, and the things I'd done were so awful and so bigger and so more horrendous. Like, it was just the worst, the biggest, you know. And people told me that AA had been around long enough that nothing I had been through and nothing I ever would get through had not already been gotten through by someone sober. Nothing. Today it's more true than ever in the world we live in. Hostages as members, military overseas are members, people who've been in horrendous situations, 9/11. There are members who've been through all those things. So it doesn't matter what we're going through today. There's somebody out there who knows what it's like and knows how to do it without picking up a drink. And I think that's all that we're here for, is to help each other do that one day at a time. So share whatever's going on with you until you find that person who can help you find a way out. And with that, I'll thank you for listening. And thanks for my sobriety.